Oborne and Heller on Cricket, brought to you by the Chiswick Calendar.
Hello, it's Peter Oborne here. It's a lovely morning in Bolton Priory in Yorkshire, where I'm going to deliver a lecture, the Sir Cuthbert's lecture later on this afternoon. But it's a beautiful place, this.
Hello, it's Richard Heller. I'm in the usual southeast London, where it's cold and damp.
And our guest today is Russell Jackson, a really notable and interesting commentator, historian of the game of cricket. And he's working on a biography of Richard and my's hero, the great cricket historian, Roland Bowen, a most singular figure, revolutionary investigator of the game. And it's very kind of Russell Jackson to come in all the way from Australia, where I think you are, Russell, to talk about Major Bowen.
Pleasure to be here.
His book was published in 1970. And Richard and I are writing a history of cricket. And this completely upturns so many of the basic assumptions of cricket history. He brought a completely radical, in fact, according to C.L.R. James, revolutionary analysis to bear. Perhaps you can tell us what do you think drove Major Bowen, who had such a very interesting life in many other ways, into writing about cricket?
It's an interesting question, you know, as to what was the motivator behind Bowen's interest in cricket. As a boy, he was sort of the son of a disgraced solicitor who I believe went broke because of some sort of betting scandal, and he got involved with bookies who he was representing as a solicitor. And the family fell on hard times, but nevertheless, Roland Bowen, this boy, he ends up at Westminster School, and he's just known among his peers as a cricket obsessive. No one has any recollections of him playing, but Michael Melford, the former cricket writer who was a classmate of Bowen's, certainly recalled down the years that, you know, he was this kid that was just obsessed with the trivia and statistics of cricket. So I guess there was some lifelong fascination that was sparked in the 1920s when he was a boy. I think his earliest recollections were games at Lord's in sort of 1921, were his earliest memories of cricket, which I think he would have been four at the time. So clearly that made a big impression on him. He goes on to be a member at the MCC. And over the years, I think what drives him towards writing this book eventually is that he's just such a contrarian, and he doesn't like the things he's reading about the game. You know, he sees every bit of cricket writing he sees, he sort of sees as inferior, and that he could do better. And a lot of people think that and don't do it. But Roland Bowen was one of those people who actually could follow through on the talk. So that's what he did. He started a quite revered cricket journal, small subscriber base, but this cricket journal called Cricket Quarterly. He started that in 1963, and the essays he published in that quarterly journal were sort of a revelation to cricket people who were really switched on to cricket history. And out of that journal grew the research for his book. And when I say grew the research, it put him in contact with a lot of other amateur historians who essentially became his gophers, who researched a lot of the book for him, and, you know, all corners of the globe finding him manuscripts and annuals and old books that he needed. He was very astute at getting people to do that gopher work for him. So it was really, I suppose, the genesis. He'd had a lifelong obsession with cricket. He was just, he couldn't stand the things he was reading, and he just thought, well, I'm the one to do this, and he did it.
It's interesting that he was, I mean, paradoxical, almost, that he was at school with Michael Melford, who was the Daily Telegraph's cricket correspondent, was he not, for many years, and a real sort of, he was a mainstream kind of writer. There you have the sort of future Telegraph voice of cricket at school with this maverick outsider. Slight, I think he has a touch of genius about him. Full, his book is, just to give a flavour of it, it's so authoritative, the way he writes. The kind of amassing of detail is superb and full of these totally unexpected insights. Like cricket starts, says Beau, in France, cricket in the Middle Ages, and then spreads to England, or his analysis of the consequences of the Imperial Cricket Conference founded at the instigation, really, of South Africa in 1911. And that at that point, the United States of America, he says, was as good a cricket team as England or Australia, and that just kills American cricket. It's full of these lateral insights, which you don't get from, say, E.W. Swanton and Altham's very good, really solid history of cricket, which was probably the dominant history at the time.
It was, and Bowen was respectful of that book, and he said, you know, through the years, he never claimed to be a prose stylist to match it with Swanton, and he had some modesty about him despite all of these sort of arrogant character traits that he did have. He viewed that book, you know, Swanton and Altham, as being the canonical text, but he thought it focused too much on first class cricket, and he wanted to take a broader view of the game on an international level. And it's interesting because we think of cricket now as, in terms of the big three and the dominance of India, England, and Australia financially and culturally on the game, the I suppose the power base of cricket in the 1960s, when Bowen is thinking and writing these things, it's even more acutely concentrated on, really at Lord's. And so for him to have taken this broad sweep that he took, and for instance, you know, he's covering Samoan cricket, Danish cricket, Brazilian cricket, Chilean cricket, to take that broader view and look at the social implications of the game in those countries, the way it evolved. C.L.R. James was right when he said it was just a totally revolutionary book. It's so many things at once. It's probably the best synoptic history of the development of cricket. It provides so many of these new insights that, you know, some of it is stuff that now that's probably amongst serious historians taken for granted because Bowen brought it to their attention so long ago. But, you know, you're right to mention American cricket. I mean, he was of the view, for instance, that John Barton King was the greatest bowler of all time. He thought that was indisputable. And that's not an opinion you would have heard among any cricket historians of the time. He looked at, the literature around the game in America, for instance, that the game supported in Philadelphia, you know, multiple weekly cricket magazines as an indicator of the health of the game. So he looked at all these factors beyond just, you know, what we would view probably quite narrowly via first class and test cricket as, you know, this is the cricket that matters. He didn't think that way.
As you were describing his background, I was very much reminded of John le Carré. Bowen was the son of a disgraced solicitor. He goes into intelligence himself professionally, doesn't he? I don't know if you've unearthed anything of what he did there, which seems to be really very obscure and very hush-hush.
Well, the main claim to fame, I suppose, in the intelligence sense, I mean, you know, he was a military man. I think a life of being an academic would have suited him, but he couldn't, that couldn't happen for him, given the family's financial affairs. So he joins the army. He spends a lot of time in India, and then he ends up in intelligence in map surveying, essentially. And his claim to fame within that field, and it's an interesting one. People say all sorts of things about this, but his claim to fame is that he was the map analyst who identified the missiles that sparked the Cuban Missile Crisis. And Of all the things people have said about Bowen over the years, a lot of people disliked him, particularly people at Lord's. His employers, in the end, disliked him immensely. But I don't think there's anyone who said that he was prone to exaggerating things. And it's very odd that multiple people down the years gave accounts to Bowen's would-be biographer, Murray Hedgecoe, that he was the guy who identified those missiles. And the thing about Murray that I should add there is we're really having this conversation because of Murray. He became aware of Bowen at the time that Cricket Quarterly was being published and developed a lifelong fascination with him. Murray died about a year ago, but he gathered so much material that he hoped would be the basis of a biography. And shortly before he passed away, he sort of left that task to me to put it all together, which I'm not sure what that will look like yet, whether it will be a full-scale biography or maybe a biographical essay that, introduces a collection of Bowen's essays or something. But Murray, when we talk about Roland Bowen and the fact that we're even having this conversation, a lot of that is down to Murray, because he just thought, this guy dies in 1978, 8 years after the book comes out. He gets very little recognition at the time, despite the value of the work he'd done. He'd alienated so many people that no one really had a good word to say about him by the time he died, but he just sort of got obscured. And this book, here we are talking about it 52 years later. Iron Spottiswood, the publisher of this book, they'd planned to print 5,000 copies. I think in the end they printed 3,500. They sold 2,500 and 1,000 were remaindered. So it never got reprinted. It's a magnificent book. You can still find it, good secondhand book dealers that will be able to track it down for you. But it only ever sold 2,500 copies, which just seems so ridiculous when we know that it's a hugely significant historical work to rank with Swanton, and that book, I don't know the figures on that, but everyone who loves cricket has that book. But Bowen's book, it's sort of more of a connoisseur's item that people who are in the know will mention him, but he sort of just faded into obscurity.
John Orlott praised his book, didn't he? Did that not do him any good for his... It made him the book of the year, I think, in his Wisden review of books.
He did. He gave a glowing review in the 1971 edition of Wisden, which I've got beside me here. He put it up the top in the rankings of books that year. Arlott was also, of course, certainly not cut from the same cloth as Bowen psychologically, but they had some overlapping political interests, I would say. They were both staunch campaigners against apartheid. And really, the link there actually is Peter Hain. Peter Hain was someone who Bowen took on as a sort of protege. And at the time, I think...
Really?
And they never met, but Hain would get these floods of letters and phone calls from Bowen. And when Hain was doing his own campaigning on that issue with respect to the 1970 South Africa tour, Hain felt as though the only people in cricket he had in his corner were John Arlott, David Shepherd and Roland Bowen. And some people would probably rank those three on different scales. Mm-hmm. But, there was the review by Arlott, which was glowing. There was the, he sort of had the imprimatur of CLR James. And there was also, unusually, at the time that the book came out, there was a 1,600-word review in the Times written by Alan Gibson. And Gibson raved about it. He also pointed out the many errors, which is a topic we'll probably get to, but... this is a quote from Alan Gibson's review in the Times. He says, "I can best illustrate its importance by saying that if only one book about cricket were to survive some general holocaust, future generations would know all the important things about the game, provided this book was the saviour."
That is a... I had no idea of Alan Gibson review. And you wouldn't have expected that again from Alan Gibson, who came over as a very engaging figure, but not really somebody who was an intellectual, you know, capable of seeing. Because this is a fundamentally a, it's a bit like E.P. Thompson's Making of the Working Class. It reinvents a whole subject and represents it. And after that, the historiography of cricket could never be the same again. It makes sense that John Ayler, such a fascinating and beautiful figure himself, with a deep comprehension of the game, would have done that review. But I'm delighted that Alan Gibson did the same.
I hadn't known that, Russell, before, that Major Bowen was a strong supporter of Peter Hayne, said one of three. I'm not sure he was a great asset to Peter Hayne as a supporter, certainly not in terms of building alliances, because he's probably one of the most quarrelsome people who's ever written and got engaged in cricket, wasn't he?
Oh, he was. I think the modern term would be troll or crank. He just alienated almost everyone he encountered. And it's interesting. I mean, what got me into my interest in Bowen, it flowed from a few things. I'd seen this photo of him in David Frith's wonderful book, Pageant of Cricket. And I thought, oh, was this this photo of this, you know, guy with this sort of clown hairstyle? And there's a little caption talking about his book and it being significant. And I thought, oh, I must get that book. And I ended up getting the book. And then I read this article in there's an Australian cricket journal called Between Wickets. And it's published by the cricket bookseller, Roger Page. And back in the 60s, Roger was Roland Bowen's literary agent in Australia, essentially. He was in charge of the Australian subscriptions for Cricket Quarterly.
Thankless task, I should imagine.
A thankless task. And so he publishes this article, this amazing article by Murray Hedgecoe about Murray's lifelong search for Roland Bowen and the enigma that he was. And that sent me to the MCC library in Melbourne because I thought, well, they've got some stuff here. They've got some papers that are to do with Bowen. I'll go and see what they are. Now, those papers were a bunch of letters that were exchanged between Bowen and the Brisbane cricket book collector, Pat Mullins. And Pat's cricket book collection, which was astonishing, eventually became the basis of the MCC's collection in Melbourne. And what I found in these letters was this quarrelsome Roland Bowen. He was talking to Pat as though Pat was his servant. For years, this went on, just get me this annual, get me that. I can't believe you like this book. You know, you're a moron, basically. I mean, Pat was a extremely intelligent man, very well read. He was a prominent lawyer in Brisbane. And Bowen just treated him like his servant. And I thought, oh, God, this is quite amazing. You know, if he corresponded like this with other people, I'm sure he rubbed people up the wrong way. And Murray shed more light on that. And basically, Bowen had these relationships as the Pat's relationship with him was a microcosm of the way he treated everyone. Every morning, Bowen would get up and write a flurry of letters that were posted off to people. There'd be a flurry of phone calls. He was always demanding things of people. Everyone had to be running around getting things for him. The letters, you know, the way he talks about people even who've helped him in his letters, it's all just so bitchy. And he was a very difficult man to get on with. And I think his saving grace, obviously, people saw that he was brilliant. And some people, to an extent, they did want to be associated with him and his work, but he pretty much wore out his welcome with everyone. There are very few people he didn't burn. Peter Wynne Thomas might be the only person who, and perhaps Roger Page, are probably the only two I've seen that didn't get completely burnt by Roland Bowen in the end.
Remind me who Peter Wynne Thomas and Roger Page were.
So Roger Page was a book dealer in Melbourne who, you know, they sort of had a mutually beneficial relationship, him and Bowen, in that when Roger went over to London on buying trips, Bowen introduced him to people to buy books off, and Roger went back to Australia and sort of spread the word about Roland Bowen's journal, Cricket Quarterly. So he took all the subscriptions for that. But those sort of alliances he formed all over the world, when we think about, you know, you guys writing a history now of cricket, there's so much information that's a keystroke away via digital archives. Bowen didn't have the benefit of that, but what he did do, he kind of had his own version of the internet, which was contacts on every corner of the globe chasing up information for him, you know, old illustrations, maps, manuscripts, books, journals. He was relentless in getting people to do that work for him because he wanted to have every available fact, I think. And he ended up making errors in the book. And, you know, there's probably a catalogue of them. And they pretty quickly issued a sort of appendix of corrections and things that got slipped into some editions of the book. But he did, within his powers, just unearth every piece of information he could for that book. And it's why it's full of such insights, is he didn't rely on, you know, there's probably a tradition in cricket history to just regurgitate things and repurpose things that other people had written. And Bowen didn't do that. He just searched and searched for the most obscure documents. And that's why the book is so interesting.
It was quite shrewd of him to enlist so many people, because he would have realised very soon that cricket is absolutely full of, you know, obsessive collectors all over the world. So engaging them as his, you know, there are people like him who have this gluttony for facts and obscure information about cricket. And it was, you know, it's shrewd of him to enlist all of them, unpaid, of course. Yeah.
Definitely.
I'd love to know about his relationship with the grandee E.W. Swanson, and who was a previous historian, as we've discussed. And I can't believe that they got on, Bowen and Swanson, very well. And I find his presence as a member of the MCC quite bizarre, given his quarrelsome nature.
Well, he ended up giving up his MCC membership in 1969 over the South Africa issue. He'd been a member since 34, so he's 17 years old when he becomes a member. I could search my brain for the nominee, but the person who nominated him did have an OBE, so he pulled some strings somewhere and he became a member. And he was renowned by the end at Lord's as just a thorn in the side of, what's the guy's name? Griffith, the MCC secretary.
S.G. Griffith, yes.
Yeah,
Billy Griffith.
And Billy Griffith at one point was set on suing Bowen for libel, because Bowen, one of his many interests was, you know, one of his hobbies, I suppose, was writing these sort of vituperative letters to the Daily Telegraph. He would have had hundreds of letters published on all sorts of topics, but his pet topic was really smashing the MCC. So he'd write all these letters into the Daily Telegraph, and Griffith took umbrage to one of them, which was critical of him. And he ended up having, I think, who was the MCC president at the time? I've got it written down somewhere.
Well, the treasurer was Gubby Allen. I have to say, while you're looking, I mean, Billy Griffith was, in my book on Basil D'Oliveira, he did not emerge. He's one of the kind of MCC conspiracy who keeps D'Oliveira out of the England team to tour South Africa. And Gubby Allen was the treasurer. The president, I think it might have been the former fascist called Gilligan at that stage. But this president is not such an important role in the MCC. It's passed on year after, for 1 year only.
I have got it here, yes. So this spat between Billy Griffith and Bowen escalates to the point that Griffith is threatening to sue for libel, and he's only talked out of that by Sir Alec Douglas Home, is the MCC president. That's as the
former prime minister. He's an ex-prime minister. He's about to be foreign secretary again in 1970, and Alec Douglas Home. It mediates between, this is glorious, a piece of information, he mediates between Billy Griffith and Roland Bowen. Go on.
And so, you know, Bowen is the thorn in the side of Griffith, and he's writing all this stuff, not only in the Daily Telegraph, but in Cricket Quarterly. And people are putting issues of Cricket Quarterly in Billy Griffith's in tray, and it's setting him off. And in the end, Sir Alec Douglas, he comes in and says, Hume says, supposedly says to Griffith, "My boy, if I had sued every time anyone said something beastly about me, I would have spent all my life in the law courts." And that diffuses it. But Bowen, you know, in that, I think it's within 12 months of that, he gives up his membership. And everyone who had what was described as the misfortune of attending a cricket game with Roland Bowen, the observation was always that he was a nightmare to watch the cricket with, because he was more interested in getting into arguments than he was watching the cricket. So people tended to avoid him. But he was also, you know, there was a period there where he also wanted to overthrow the committee. As the 60s wore on, he became more and more radical in his political thinking, which was, you know, there were people that just didn't want to associate with him in any way. And the great quote, I think I used it when I wrote about Bowen a few years back, he was interviewed by Andrew Joseph of the Australian Cricket Society and asked for his political outlook and, you know, the way he viewed society. And he said, "Ideally, I'm an anarchist, by which I mean that in a suitable intelligent society, anarchy in its real sense would be, to use an Irishism, the accepted form of government. I do not believe that the traditional institutions of society are worth maintaining or preserving once they themselves have lost any useful living content to which an intelligent person can give his assent. I believe this applies as much to the greater part of British political life and institutions at the present time. We live in a fast-changing society, and much to which willing assent would have been given 20 years ago is now an empty sham." And at the end of that tirade, he says to Joseph, "There is even a good case for nationalizing Lords." So you can sort of see why he wasn't a particular favorite of the higher-ups at the MCC.
In a certain way, Lords did. He got his wish, didn't he? I mean, the MCC is sort of replaced as the ruler of English and indeed world cricket by a semi-public body. So he wasn't totally off the beam there. But he founds Cricket Quarterly. It's a subscription only, I think, magazine. But he actually quarrels with most of his with a lot of his subscribers, doesn't he? And he actually sacks, you know, subscribers, which is a strange business model for a publisher.
It's a very strange business model. I mean, people were always being barred from the list, and he was always conducting these sort of investigations of suspicious names on the subscriber list who he suspected were people using assumed names. And his correspondence with people just about the issue of the subscriber list was hilarious. And towards the end of the life of Cricket Quarterly, so it ran from 63 through to the start of 1971, there was an issue. And this is just after his book has come out. And he's starting to run out of steam as a historian. He's sort of said what he's wanted to say. And Peter Wynne Thomas, the budding cricket historian at that time, he says to Bowen, you know, Peter was a contributor to the Quarterly. And he said, "Well, you know, should I take over?" And they to and fro about it, and they can't come to terms. And I think Peter's words were, "In the end, Bowen decided it should remain a monument to himself." And so they don't continue it. But what happens is that subscriber list, the much, the thing that Bowen consumed him, this subscriber list, I think Peter and someone else tried to use it as the basis for the Association of cricket scorers and historians were putting out a journal, and they wanted to use that list. And Bowen hit the roof about that. Mm. You know, he was proprietorial about it even after Cricket Quarterly had finished. So you name it, anything, any situation in which he could be difficult, he was. He was just quite a ridiculous man.
This business of cancelling subscribers, Kelvin McKenzie, the famous editor of The Sun at his peak, would do the same. There was one occasion in the Sun newsroom when there was a call, and it was somebody in, I think, Brighton ringing up to complain about an article in The Sun. And Kelvin insisted on taking the phone call and saying, what's the name of your news agent? And the lady concerned gave that name. Right, you're banned from reading The Sun. Hmm. And there is this kind of, you know, Kelvin was probably the most brilliant newspaper editor of the second half of the 20th century. And there is a sort of element there of Bowen as well.
Oh, he was, you know, he was a genius and he knew it. And he just didn't, I mean, it would be wrong to say he didn't suffer fools. He just had a hair trigger temper for things. Any hint of someone being associated with South Africa in any way or Zimbabwe, they would be cut off immediately. There's a funny story I read about the book dealer, John McKenzie, who I believe came from South Africa. And his,
he did originate, yeah.
Yeah, his introduction to Bowen was basically one exchange, because once Bowen knew that he'd come from South Africa, he was, you know, in Bowen's eyes, responsible for the whole regime. So he fixated on certain things, but it could be anything that set him off as far as taking someone off the list. They could complain about an article or something like that. One thing I should say as far as the Cricket Quarterly goes, obviously, is that, you know, we've all probably think the book should be reissued. There's also probably a case that Cricket Quarterly could be all bound together and put out as a compendium. I think a full set of them, the eight volumes, you can probably pick it up for about £300 in your money, but it's sort of it's out of sight, out of mind, and it's full of amazing essays. The book reviews are particularly great. I mean, when I wrote about Bowen a few years ago, I probably focused a bit too much on his poison pen reviews. In fact, he also gave praise where it was due. And I think when you talk about book criticism, really the best book critics are an advocate for the reader. And Bowen was definitely an advocate for the reader, to the point that the publishers feared him and stopped sending him books, which, looking at the evidence of what happened after that, they were stupid to stop sending him the books, because if a bad book, if he'd had to pay for it, he was even more savage than if they just sent him a free copy.
I also, from what you're saying, Russell, you know, not just his sort of collected works, but his collected letters to the Daily Telegraph, I think, should be reissued at some time. Tell me what the other subjects were that he wrote to the Telegraph about, apart from cricket.
Well, you know, he had so many obsessions. You know, some of them were perhaps not so interesting. I mean, his daily train from Eastbourne would apparently always idle outside London for 5 minutes. And so he waged this endless war with the station master that people who were close to Bowen said it almost consumed his life, that outside of cricket research, his two obsessions for a while were this issue of the train, and there was a soft drink company that Bowen was at war with because they promised they had, it was something like 12 flavours in their range, and Bowen could only find 11 of them. And so he was waging war against this soft drink company that was lying about how many flavours they had. So he was a total crank. But as far as his interests, I mean, what he did in cricket, he did not to the same extent, but with other topics. What he would do is he'd become obsessed with a certain issue, whether it was Catholicism, medieval farming, classical music, wrestling. He was a huge Tolkien fan. big science fiction fan, he would become an expert on that topic. And when I say expert, he would buy every available book, learn everything about it. And then once he was done with the topic and felt as though he'd conquered it, he just got rid of everything. So his cricket library, he ended up in financial straits towards the end of his life, which we'll get into the reasons for that soon. But he'd just get rid of the library of whatever the topic was. So his letters to the Daily Telegraph, they really vary. There's a political flavour to a lot of them. But I think if we're talking about Roland Bowen's obsessions beyond cricket, the thing that most people who know of him know is that he amputated his own leg. And the amputation of his own leg was really the culmination of a long obsession with amputation. He'd removed one of his fingers, which he told people he'd done that while chopping up meat for his dogs. His dogs were another total obsession of his life. He believed that one of his dogs, Rob, he believed was the reincarnation of his grandmother. So he's obsessed with these dogs and supposedly chopping up meat and chops his finger off, but nobody believes that because he becomes absolutely obsessed with amputation and blindness. And he is eventually deliberately loses the sight in one eye. And he famously amputates his own leg in his bathroom in 1968, which foreshadows his, forced early retirement from the Joint Intelligence Bureau, which, he was just short of his pension. So his financial security, doing this crazy thing of amputating his own leg, it costs him his job right at the end of his career, denies him his pension, and he sort of, it's not a total spiral into poverty, but he only lives another 10 years and he gets married, unexpectedly married in that time, but he sort of just fades into obscurity in the aftermath of the book because he's, hobbling around on this prosthetic leg.
He gets married late in life, becomes a stepfather, doesn't he? Intrigued by when you said he becomes obsessed with blindness because he becomes a stepfather to two visually handicapped stepsons, doesn't he?
That's
a very good stepfather.
Very much so. And, for all of the, for all of his eruptions and all of his the difficulties he had maintaining any kind of relationship, he was, by all reports, a very caring and loving stepfather. He gets married. His two stepsons are visually impaired. He also, it turns out, in the aftermath of the thing I wrote, there was this story about Bowen having sent a Braille watch to a blind boy in Northern Ireland, that he'd read about in the paper. And that boy became a man who later wrote an article about it, how this total stranger, British military man, and the family are thinking, God, what's this letter? And he sends him this Braille watch that he keeps for the rest of his life. So he was capable of, really, really touching acts as well. So, his stepsons are, they're still around and were able to provide me with some photos and things and just had really fond recollections of him. They were obviously aware of his reputation as a historian and just, they knew him really as the oddball that lived with their mum for a few years.
Yeah. That's, I'm interested they're still alive. Do they have any rights over his history?
Possibly. I would think, I would think if there is an estate as such, it would sit with them. And if they were keen on republishing the book, someone should do it. I mean, my experience in the past in publishing is that a lot of publishers who have these kinds of books on their backlist don't realise it, often don't even possess a copy. And when you point it out to them, they want an arm and a leg for the rights. But Look, you would hope someone could do it. I think the ideal scenario for a republication would be that there was a, you know, perhaps a biographical essay before it and a full list of corrections and footnotes and things. Because he did, he created a lot of, Bowen created a lot of footnotes to add to it himself. So all of those things could be added in. The commercial market for that now, I'm not sure, but someone should do it.
Very much so. Give us a flavour of the mistakes, because he was such a powerful intellect. It's a little bit surprising that he made mistakes.
And he admitted some of them. I mean, he the one that everyone points out, I think, is the issue of the French, you know, origins of the game, and this issue of the word Craig, C-R-E-A-G. Gibson actually went into that in his review. I think Bowen said, no one scholar or other has ever come up with any other explanation that Craig was, this is Gibson saying that Craig was cricket. And it just didn't, you know, it's a Gaelic word meaning a foray or booty or plunder. And Gibson said, well, that these are terms that could apply to children's games, you know, that it's not necessarily cricket. Whereas, you know, Bowen, once he got an idea in his head, he was just sort of set on it. But that, you know, that's an example of it. There were lots of small errors, but there were, you know, part of the appeal of the book, I think, is that people will disagree with it. I think Arlott's review alluded to that. He said, importantly, his book is frequently informative, often fresh, at times exasperating, but always readable. And I think that's true. You know, it prompted a lot of debate. And that really, if we look back at the origins of the book, this idea that, you know, Bowen thought everyone else was wrong, it all started, he had this ongoing feud with Roy Webber, the cricket statistician, and there was a, you know, I think Bowen's origin story as a historian was that he was watching this quiz show on TV, and there was a question about the early champions of county cricket, the early years of the county championship, and they based the answer on Roy Webber's research, and Bowen saw it and erupted and said, you know, there's more in Haygarth's scores and biographies, and he basically set out to you know, blow Webber out of the water, and then all of his research sort of grew from that. I think Roy Webber died a year later, and then within a year of that, Bowen starts publishing Cricket Quarterly and you know, basically issuing essay length corrections of all of these things that people had taken for granted about cricket history.
Did he write all of Cricket Quarterly himself? Or were there people who were unlucky? Were there outside contributors?
There were outside contributors, yeah.
Were they unlucky enough to be edited by him, which must have been a pretty fearsome process?
I have seen glimpses of the editing process via his correspondence, and yeah, he was a pretty brutal editor and tended to get his way. And that, you know, that Peter Wynne Thomas saying it was a monument to himself is correct, but he did see the value in some of the work that others were doing. So there were, yeah, I think, you know, you'd be surprised at some of the names that are mentioned in the journal. And just you know, that as per the book, just topics that were totally unexpected that you wouldn't see in the Cricketer or Playfair Cricket Monthly at that point. And of course, the other reason that Bowen started the journal beyond wanting total dictatorial control of the publication was that he'd worn out his welcome with the Cricketer. You know, E.W. Swanton barred him from the Cricketer, and he also wasn't allowed to write for Playfair Cricket Monthly anymore because people just felt, you know, he was too difficult to deal with.
Why did E.W. Swanton bar him from the Cricketer?
I can't recall the exact reason, but Swanton was definitely not a fan.
And vice versa. You can imagine those two characters not getting on, the establishment and the anti-establishment.
Well, Jim Swanton was the Pope of cricket, and you know, you could almost say Major Bowen was the Luther. Yes.
Yes, that's a nice analogy.
Cricket Quarterly had a subtitle which intrigued me. A journal devoted to the noble game of cricket, he called it. Underneath it all, he was a great debunker of myths, but he was really quite a romantic about cricket, wasn't he, Major Bowen?
He was. And you know, that a little bit was made of his criticisms of Cardiff, but actually, you know, Cardiff being the great romantic. But I think what Bowen didn't like were the Cardiff imitators. I think Cardiff himself he could handle. And a lot of his, you know, his love of the game, clearly Bowen's love of the game stemmed from that early childhood fascination. But he, you know, I was saying before about the book reviews in Cricket Quarterly, and yeah, he could fly off the handle. There's a thing he says in one review that I always find myself repeating these days being a journalist. When someone says something to me about writing, I think back to this Bowen line where he's reviewing a book by one of the Workaday reporters, and he says, he's a journalist and he writes at a journalistic level. You know, it's just this very like harsh put down. But, you know, in with all of that, he wrote with great insight about other books, and that came to my attention. Gideon Haig was writing an essay about Ken Barrington and his struggle with depression, and there wasn't a lot. You can imagine in 1968, there wasn't a lot written about the topic or much understanding about it. And when Gideon mentioned it to me, I said, oh, I'm certain Roland Bowen reviewed the ghost-written book that Barrington put out at that time. And sure enough, he had. And there's a great amount of psychological insight in Bowen's review of the Barrington book. I mean, he sort of writes it off as, you know, this is just a ghost-written mid-career biography type thing, but it is significant in that it's a player, you know, one of the first players talking about the mental strain of the game.
But I know knew he's dead now, the man who ghost wrote that book. The reason I got to know him is that he ghost wrote Basil D'Oliveira's first book in 1968. And he told me that he wrote that book in 2 weeks flat. It was a week speaking to Barrington, or a bit less perhaps. And then he put the whole thing together in the week after that. He was a former foreign correspondent of the Daily Express and obviously worked extremely fast. How interesting that he'd had that element to it.
Of it, Bowen says, I've just pulled out the issue. This is the spring 1968 issue of Cricket Quarterly. And he says, it is obvious to even a non-medical mind that what Barrington needed was not pills, but a specialist. If the book has any value, which we doubt, it is to show, but surely not for the first time, how an individual endowed neither by birth nor other circumstances with the instincts and training which could have toughened him enough mentally cracks under the strain when placed in circumstances too great for his own persona to sustain. You know, it's a very strong psychological insight, talking about an issue that absolutely nobody in cricket talked about, which was, like I said, the mental toll of playing the game.
That's Jungian language, of course, that Major Bowen is using there.
Yeah.
And of course, Cab Barrington, a bit tough. I mean, Barrington is one of possibly the most underrated post-war English cricketer, but Richard and my great friend is dead now. Alan Watkins, political correspondent, he told me he was planning to write a biography of Barrington before he died. And Barrington was the ultimate symbol of courage. I mean, moral and personal courage, was he not? You know, he averaged 60 again and again, coming in at number three. That's where he was sent into bat. He would hold the innings together against some of the greatest attacks of the world, that Australian team, the West Indies team of those eras. And yes, there was immense strain, and he had the heart attacks, which killed him very young. But what a figure, and how interesting. I mean, that is why Major Bowen is so interesting, is he sees so deeply and so quickly.
Absolutely. Peter, before you asked me what Swanton thought of Roland Bowen, and I have had time to dig up a reminisce that Murray Hedgecoe got from Swanton about Roland Bowen. It's only one paragraph, but I'll read it for you. "I wish I could help you about Roland Bowen, whom I remember as quite the most contrary, if not the most impossible fellow I ever came across in the world of cricket. I have had another look at his book published in 1970. I notice he says in reference to Gary Sobers, there are two opinions about his greatness. No one can have much confidence in the judgment of a critic who writes that. I wrote a fairly sharp review of his book in either the Daily Telegraph or the Cricketer or both. There is no doubt he unearthed a good deal of hitherto unpublished material, but such a pity he spoiled it by unreasoning venom and a seeming bias against authority."
To put it mildly, interesting that Major Bowen should talk about Ken Barrington's mental problems. Coming from a man with... so many mental issues of his own, so many eccentricities of his own, a man who amputates his own leg and I think actually generated the scientific term for a morbid obsession with amputation. Tell us a little bit more about this extraordinary obsession. How long did it last? You say he cuts off his finger first. Is it a sort of something lifelong? Have you seen anything that suggests how it was generated?
Well, the term that later came into use is apotemnophilia, I think, a neurological disorder characterized by an intense and long-standing desire for amputation of a specific limb. That didn't come into use until about a decade after Bowen did this, but I think it would be selling it short to say he was just obsessed with amputating a specific limb. The general issue of amputation consumed him. There was a chap that he used to get the train with who Bowen would always say on the way to work, he would talk about amputation and his wish to amputate his leg, for which there was no medical reasoning. So there was some sort of pathology at play there. But I think, you know, Bowen was, he was obsessed with science fiction and sort of, paranormal and unexplainable things. We also have to bear in mind that, you know, for most of his, I suppose, until he was in his late 40s, homosexuality was illegal in Britain. And there's a lot of evidence to suggest that he was homosexual. He was involved in... the underground gay poetry scene, for instance, reading, reviewing and writing poetry for some sort of quite obscure gay poetry publications. So his psychological profile would be very hard to pin down as far as, you know, what drove any of these things that he did in his private life. It certainly wasn't the observation of anyone who knew him that he was perverse or perverted, but he was a very strange man who probably struggled with his identity in some way. And that, you know, that comes through in little, you just get little glimpses of it in letters and observations of people. You know, there's one observation from one of his stepsons that there was a discussion on TV about gay rights, and Bowen sort of says, you know, too right, and sort of surprises the stepson that you know, an old guy is so progressive. But I think there was a lot going on behind the veil. So as far as, you know, the amputation thing goes, it was something that I can't lie that when I became interested in Bowen, it was one of the things that I thought, you know, as a journalist, you think in terms of three things that could be in a headline. And it was like, here's a guy who amputated his own leg, there's one. Here's a great cricket historian, unheralded, there's two. and he was possibly a spy. So there's he was an enigma, and as much as Murray uncovered about him, I think there would still be so much more that he probably kept to himself.
Carrying on that theme, so he goes to a conventional English public school. He joins the British Army. He's out there in India. He almost certainly does join MI5, I would have thought. He would have been a brilliant intelligence researcher. And being in MI5 and gay at that period probably was extremely complicated, and he may have had to keep it totally secret. Who knows? And so all of that complexity is going on as well.
And there's the complexity of his family scenario. I mean, interestingly, his father, his father, I believe, went to prison during his fall from grace. But his father lived in poverty for the last 20 years of his life, but lived to be 80. And I think in the last 20 years of his life, between 1948 and 68, Bowen saw his father only once. And there were definitely, there's a big issue there as far as the divide in the family. He had a very complicated personal life. And people didn't, I suppose a lot of people didn't really see that. And as far as his military career, he was in India for a long time. It's most likely, if he was MI5 at any point, there's a lot to suggest that that would have been in the 1950s. So as you say, Peter, that's an era where, there's all sorts of thorniness around those things for a guy in intelligence.
He just would have been, out of the intelligence service immediately, wouldn't he? As a homosexual, he'd have been regarded in that era as an automatic security risk, wouldn't he?
I would think, there are probably people better placed to speak about that part of it than me. But, you look at what happened when he amputated his leg, they just went, well, he's insane and we need to get rid of him. And they did. They just immediately got rid of him. And you do sort of wonder, his dismissal from the service, I do wonder about a couple of things there. A, whether they knew about his sexuality, and secondly, more so, whether these sort of situations he got himself in with powerful people at the MCC, whether that played a role in it. He did rub a lot of powerful people up the wrong way. So, he was pretty quickly cast aside.
One additional point there, of course, is that during the late 60s, the British intelligence machinery was very much alongside South Africa, i.e. The British intelligence worked very closely with BOS, the South African intelligence agencies, and I uncovered quite a lot of that in my book on D'Oliveira. So he would have made himself very, if he was working for MI5, he would have been very unpopular with aspects within MI5 because of his hostility to South Africa. Remember, apartheid South Africa was a structural part of the Cold War architecture right up to 1990. And so that the attacking apartheid was the same as attacking the sort of American alliance.
Mm. I mean, to draw all this together into, an interesting thing in his book, I think one other thing he had was an insight for things being, through his intelligence work and his personality makeup, he had a sharp eye for things that were suppressed and things that were hidden and that people didn't want to talk about. And the great example of that in the book is what he writes about W.R. Gilbert, who is the cousin of W.G. Grace. His cricket career came to a sudden end because he was found stealing in the dressing room, and that was a totally taboo topic. It was hushed up, and Gilbert emigrated to Canada. And Bowen says in a footnote to the book that he was urged not to publish that story. But he did. Yeah. And he sort of, I think he did that as a bit of a point to say, so much of cricket history is about suppressing things and painting a rosy picture of things, and that it's this, you know, this wonderland, this romantic wonderland, and it's not. It's an extension of life and everything that you know, people do.
Russell, it's been absolutely fascinating hearing you talk about Major Bowen. There's obviously much more we could have said about, you could tell us about him, and there's much more to be discovered about him, I'm sure. Very much hope you'll bring out your book about him.
For all his eccentricity, I think he's a magnificent figure. I revere him. I think anybody who is involved in cricket history or loves cricket should revere somebody like this, who loved the game too and treated it in such an original and deep way and was so far ahead of his time on so many issues, including race in cricket. So, you know, he anticipates by 50 years critical race theory in many ways. I think he's a great figure. I honour him.
Peter, as you said, you know, he anticipated critical race theory. Being a contrarian as he was, Bowen, I discovered through the letters, yes, he was essentially an anti-racist. He devoted a lot of his energy to fighting against apartheid and these issues, but he was also at the same time a horrendous anti-Semite.
Well, that's very depressing, because in so many ways he's so much of a sort of advanced figure. And in light of what you've said about his anti-Semitism, we must certainly have you back, Russell, for a further discussion of this extraordinary man.
Look forward to it.
Thank you very, very much for joining us. It's been a wonderful conversation. Very much hope we'll talk to you again very, really quite soon, when you've done more about him. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Richard Heller. It's still southeast London. It's still cold and damp.
It's rather a lovely day here in Bolton Priory. And do you know what I'm going to do now? I'm in the old rectory and about 100 or 200 yards away from where I am, but I arrived late last night. I haven't got there yet. Is the grave of one of the greatest cricketers who ever walked this earth, a certain F.S. Truman. And I'm going to go from this room to the grave and honour that tremendous character, tremendous cricketer.